The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thank you, Peter. Do be writing your questions down as we go, please, because I'm keen for a good Q&A. One of the things that I've certainly seen going through in preparation for this is that the little book of Esther just raises so many questions. It drives me to a humility that says, look, I'm learning things a lot as I come to this, and I think we'll learn a lot together. As we said last week, Esther is a strange book. It doesn't mention God explicitly, not even once. On the surface, it reads like watching a Game of Thrones, right? Intrigue, violence, murder, sex, politics, and lots of power struggles that take place. It's an amazing story, and it's one that is worth a careful and repeated kind of reading. It's one that's drawn from history. So it takes place in the court of Xerxes I, the king of Persia. So we're talking about 486 BC that he comes to power. And last week, as we looked at chapters 1 and 2, we saw that the Persian Empire at this time is just all-conquering. It has no rival in the world. It stretches from northern Africa through to India, up through Syria into Turkey, and all nations kind of fall before it. And Xerxes is at the top of the tree without equal. And yet, even in the way that court is described, we saw that there's hints that I think we're supposed to laugh, that Xerxes, the one who has all power, isn't able to command his wife to come and appear before him, you know? That in the middle of this drunk feast, he relies on this council of lawyers and advisors, political staffers, who bungle and end up getting rid of the queen that he loves. Queen Vashti disappears, and in chapter 2 we see Esther appears as the new queen, put in place through Mordecai, the Jewish cousin of Esther, who says to her, keep your Jewish identity hidden. Don't show yourself to be one of God's people. There's an element there that already warns us that this could be a dangerous place to reveal who you really are. Mordecai goes on to foil an assassination attempt that was being hatched by bodyguards. And interestingly, although it's not here in the biblical text, we know that Xerxes goes on to be killed by two of his bodyguards. So the head of his bodyguard and one of the eunuchs gather together, and Xerxes is killed. So Mordecai, you know, saves his life, and if only he was around again, maybe he would have lived longer. But that was the way that Xerxes came to an end. But in the reading that Peter started, and which is there printed on the outline, you see a change of direction takes place. Maybe because of the fear for his life, Xerxes appoints this prime minister who's to have honour above all the other rulers of the land. In fact, if the first two chapters are filled with long lists of advisors and lawyers and staffers and eunuchs, and they're all named, by the time you get to chapter 3 on, all those names just disappear. And you're just left with the name of Haman. Haman, who is the villain of the piece, the one who is Hitler-like in the way that he will try and bring about this genocide of all the Jewish people throughout the Persian Empire. He's given a seat above the other nobles, and they all bow before him. He alone is the one who's going to have the power of the king. They give him honour like that. Well, I say all, but there is one who would not bow, and that one is Mordecai. If his name sounds Jewish to us today, it's only because he is honoured in that way by the Jews today, who will name children Mordecai. At the time, his name sounded Persian, for it is a Persian name, and it's named after the god Marduk. That's the origin of Mordecai. And so you have someone here who is resisting the tyrannical rule of this new Haman, the villain who's come into place. And as he does that, he really is outing himself and his Jewish identity for what seems the first time. The royal officials at the gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behaviour would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. See, what you have there is not just a one-off anger, but a steadfast refusal, a kind of pattern of civil disobedience that is taking place. They warn him, and he still will not bow like that. And, of course, we still see a concern today for people not to be in contempt of court. You know, you must kind of stand for the court, bow as you enter, and so on. Respect still needs to be paid. But we're in a slightly different category here, because in the Bible, there's generally no problem with people paying respect to rulers, to bowing before rulers and kings. The issue really is that one cannot bow before idols. So it's idolatry that you can't join in, that you can't bow before. There's nothing wrong with respect. And so why is it that Mordecai won't bow? We're not told explicitly, but I wonder whether Mordecai is actually saying that the rule that he sees taking place here is an idolatrous kind of rule. Here is one who is assuming all power, that leaves no space for other voices or for a rule of law, but instead here is one who wants all power and uses it for his own purposes and uses it to destroy the enemies of God's people. To destroy God's people. So he sets himself up in enmity with God, really, in doing that. And there's a hint in the way that Haman is introduced. And often in the Old Testament, when you have a character introduced for the first time, you look very carefully at the way they're introduced. And you see here that there's a big clue given as he's described as an Agagite. And with that, there's an association back another 1,000 years to King Agag, another one of the enemies of God's people as they flee Egypt in the Exodus. Here is someone who plots their destruction. So it's a long conflict that's associated just with his name. And Haman is just enraged as he finds out that there's this civil disobedience taking place. You see that there in the verse that's got the number 5 there next to it. When Haman saw that Mordecai wouldn't kneel down or pay him honour, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. It's an awful moment. Mordecai will not stand, and so I will kill all the Jews in the Persian Empire. I said he was Hitler-like, and here he is, and this will be his final solution, his genocide, the destruction of the Jews that he wants. The Nazis, Hitler, saw the connections with this, banned the reading of the Book of Esther, banned the celebration of Purim, the feast that celebrates this story, and insisted that the synagogues be closed on that day. And within the death camps, there was a whispering, a recitation of the story of Esther to give hope that God would bring about salvation for his people, that this would not be the end, that the Hamans of this world will meet their judgment. And we can't, I don't think it's possible really to read the story of Esther in 2018 without thinking of what took place in the Second World War and without the horror that brings. I do that as a Gentile, as an outsider to that story, but one who wants to respect it. And I've visited Auschwitz, I've seen one of the big surprises there was just the industrial scale of Birkenau, just to see how big it was, how organised it was on German lines, you kind of expect. And I've spoken to survivors in Sydney and spent a lot of time at the Jewish Museum. And working in religious freedom, the Jewish community in Australia really take the lead in many ways in this space, because they've seen unspeakable evil and they want to encourage the world to say never again, not just for the Jewish people, but for any people. But the thing that intrigues me in reading this is not just the way that it's an evil act that Haman does, but the way he actually uses the law as an instrument to achieve his purposes. We'll come back to this next week, but you see that it's not just Persian brutality that's at work, but a Persian bureaucracy, that his rage is actually given expression in legislation. He acts against God and rebels against him in ways that can be published and distributed and people are asked to obey. You know, and I think there's a word of warning there for those of you who practice, to think, are politicians overreaching and using the law for their own evil ends sometimes? Are there dangers here of a system of politics that won't open itself up to a council of different voices, of different advisors? Certainly here in Persia, we see an awful situation where the king has just delegated justice out to a despotic prime minister. We've got to be people who see warnings here and I think go away treasuring divided government, treasuring the restriction that comes with the rule of law, warning governments against trying to shut down open criticism and media and things like that. Haman here uses law for evil ends, and I think there's a big warning. He's superstitious as well, as the Persians were, and so he does consult the pure, cast the lot, roll the dice, the kind of equivalent. And the Persians did this all the time. They want to go into battle, and so they, you know, sacrifice children from the local area, bury them alive in order to make it lucky for them to do this. But he plots in this way, finds the date that he wants and comes to the king and says, you see there in verse 8, there are certain people dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all other people. They do not obey the king's laws. It's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them. I'll give 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators for the royal treasury. Now, this access to the king in order to get power, he speaks half-truths through this. You know, the people here are dispersed. It's true. They are separate. Their customs are different. But they don't obey the king's laws? Well, the thing that he doesn't disclose is that the only law that's described as not being obeyed is the one of bowing before Haman. Now, he's not actually being upfront there as to why he's enraged by that. It's all his ego which is in play. It's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them? Well, it is in the king's best interest. The king wouldn't have been alive but for Mordecai saving him from his bodyguards. So they're slippery words, they're deceptive words, and we're not to trust them, but the king does. And the king is foolish enough to not even ask who the people are. You know, who are these? He doesn't even ask that question. Instead, the king takes his signet ring from his finger, a sign of his authority, you know, his the law-making ability, and he gives it to Haman. And again, it's described there as the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Keep the money, the king said. Do with the people as you please. So he gives away his legislative power. He opens up the treasury and he gives him unfettered discretion to act according to his evil designs. This is not good government. This is not good government. Genocide, sure, go for it. Execute all the Jews in the mighty Persian Empire. See how the stakes have been raised here. This is no longer just about Haman's simple act of disobedience, but something instead that plots a collision between the mighty Persian Empire and all the Jews who've been scattered throughout it. I don't think we can feel the horror that must have come upon the people at that time when the murderous bureaucracy of the Persian Empire kind of swung into action. The date had been set, it was about a year away, and that is the future that awaits them. What can a scattered and apparently powerless people do in the face of such evil? And the answer that God gives is not the one that we would expect. See, what do we expect? We expect some great miraculous act from God. You know, he'll send plagues and destruction and save his people. Or that he'll send a strong man, you know. Here comes, a David who will wipe out the enemies. But here, in the face of this evil, God sends Esther. Esther, who has concealed her identity to this point. Esther, who's, been selected by the king as his queen by winning a sex slave beauty competition. But Esther, the one who seems weak, the one who doesn't seem to have power. Mordecai, her cousin, comes to her and gives her this bone-chilling demand. She must be the one to go into the presence of Xerxes and demand that he repeal this bloodthirsty policy. And the words of the challenge are these. Don't think that because you're in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. See, the warning is there is going to be no safe space, not even in the king's palace. You will not be safe. But there's also a confidence, and it is remarkable, that deliverance will come. God will keep his promises. Now, you can do it, or it will come from some other place, but it will come because there's a confidence that God saves his people. He will not abandon them. He will keep them. He's made promises to Abraham which he will never back away from. And despite the disobedience and that has come, that's brought the judgment of the exile, God's intention is still to save his chosen people. Here, scattered and facing this terrible evil. And Esther is the one who's being chosen to save. Now, Esther is no fool, and she knows that despite being queen, her position is very fragile. Her leverage is limited. You know, the king may well love her, but for her to take on the decree that he's issued, sounds a lot like what Queen Vashti did in saying, I'm not going to come before you. And that didn't work out, you know. It means that she is putting her own untried credibility up against the policy that's being implemented by Haman, the one that the king has shown that he trusts with all power. So she's going to take a stand against the king and his prime minister. And we're told, too, that Xerxes hadn't seen her for a month. Now, let me be blunt here. What that means is he hadn't slept with her for a month. Now, he's presumably had access to the harem at that time. And so he hasn't felt the need to call on her for a month, and yet she's supposed to just walk into his presence. To walk into his presence was something you didn't do with a Persian king. I was in Parliament on Tuesday trying to get into the presence of some senators, and you can't do it without lining up appointments and getting access. And, you know, there's that kind of dance of, you know, can you do it? Will you? Who are you? And that kind of stuff. But back in the day, in the Persian court, if you approach the king without permission, then you just lose your head. There's bas reliefs that they found in one of the palaces, which has actually got a picture of. They think it's Darius, actually, the father of Xerxes, who has a scepter to show that he's the king and he can forgive people and so on. But behind him are these bodyguards with axes, right? And so you come into the presence of the king without an invitation, and you may not leave with your head. That's what she is being asked to do, to approach unbidden. That is capital punishment. And it means that the first thing, hurdle for her to overcome is that she's going to have the king's permission, the king's forgiveness for what she does, even in approaching him. And she doesn't know how he'll react. And remember, at this point, he doesn't know that she is Jewish. She's kept that from him. How will he react when she discloses that? Her name is a Persian name. It means star. She's kept her Jewish name secret. But Esther seizes the moment and says, I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. And so she fasts for 3 days and goes in looking as miserable as any of us would look if you'd fasted for 3 days and thought you were about to lose your life, right? She didn't come in as someone looking like she was about to win a beauty contest. She came in as someone who didn't look attractive, someone who looked weak and powerless, someone who potentially could kind of lose their life. She's facing death. She's pleading for his people. It's actually a model of the way that God will save his people. Not through power, but through weakness. Not through a great royal king who comes to conquer all before him, but instead one who does not look impressive and pleads for the people. Now, of course, as we come to the New Testament and to a kind of Christian understanding of the way that God works in the world, we see parallels, don't we, in the way that Christ comes in weakness, unimpressive, powerless, before the great king, pleading for the people, going in alone in weakness like that. There is that connection which is there. But what we don't know is that if she gets that access, what is she going to do with it? How could she possibly make the case that will save the people? And what's to be done if these laws have been issued and have gone out throughout the empire? Well, I'm going to leave the story hanging there and encourage you to read on. We'll certainly come back to it next week and to see where the action goes. But I do want to open it up for Q&A. Okay, there's quite a number, like about half those questions actually pick up the theme of civil disobedience. And so let me read one of the questions that picks up most of the themes. And if your question doesn't get read, then that's okay. But I'm answering it as well. Okay. The Book of Esther gives one example of how to respond to government or political persecution. What does the New Testament say about how Christians should respond to persecution or pressure from governments? Do Christians just have to cop it sweet, or are there other options? Would it ever be acceptable to take up arms? I'm not encouraging anyone to take up arms, because that could be a criminal offence, I think. Although maybe that's not a bad thing. The Bible is really surprising. There's no other text in antiquity that really gives a consistent narrative that says, you know, sometimes it is okay to defy rulers. Now, it's not a revolutionary text that says just do that always. Usually it's obey God, honour the king, right? But there are times when laws are to be disobeyed. And I think that points us to an understanding that says that even rulers are subject to a ruler in heaven. That there can be laws which come out which are quite legal, but which are wrong and which are unjust. And so, you know, according to German law, the Holocaust probably was quite legal. And yet it's immoral and it's evil and it was to be resisted and subject to civil disobedience. So too here in Esther, we have a situation where a law comes out which is terrible and needs to be resisted. I'm reading the three-part Taylor Branch biography of Martin Luther King Jr.'s life, and up to the part where they're crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, marching to Montgomery. You might have seen it in the movie. They call it Selma, I think, the movie a couple of years back. And 2 days before that march took place, the Bloody Sunday March, there'd been a funeral for a protester who'd been killed. And at that funeral, they read from Esther. And minister who was there said, "I'm calling this situation," and kind of saying that Governor Wallace is in the same position of Xerxes, and we need to march to him and saying there's a plot here to kill God's people, because they're seeing churches being bombed at that stage, and it was being done in part by the local level, not the state level, but the local level sheriffs, who were actually driving a lot of the action being taken by the Ku Klux Klan. So at that point, just as in the Holocaust, just as in Hamas Day, you're having people saying, yeah, we understand that you've got power and you're using it with the rule of law, but there's a power that you ought to be held accountable to. And part of their reaction to it is to be subversive and not to go along with that law. Now, they are cases at the extreme. I don't think it's normal for us to say, yeah, take up arms or lightly disobey. And sometimes civil disobedience will mean that people will find themselves in prison. So the greatest, probably, the two great 20th century texts on this are Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham Jail, which talks about the need for civil disobedience and why it is that people should do it, and the letters of Dietrich Bonhoeffer writing from prison in Germany. Both of which pick up that theme. I think it's one that we haven't had to think about much because, you know, we've got so much to be thankful for here about, you know, good government and good law. And can say that even given the dysfunction of Canberra over the last year, you know, we still don't have a tyrannical kind of situation, even if it's dysfunctional. But yeah, I think we do need to think longer and harder about the place of civil disobedience, and I think if there is to be a cultural move that sees people of faith more and more at odds with a cultural grounding of what's good, then there's going to be a bigger call for that. So the more people say the church is evil and it needs to be controlled, the more people within the church are going to have to say, well, what does it mean to obey laws here which will go against my conscience and so on. So it's a good question and series of questions from people here. Thank you. What would have been the problem for Mordecai to kneel and pay honour to the king's representative? Shouldn't Mordecai have obeyed this command of the king? Well, I think really we're not told explicitly why it is that Mordecai doesn't act, but I think the way the story goes suggests that Mordecai sees a idolatrous rule taking place of a system of government that he's actually calling out as evil. And I think what Haman goes on to do in calling for the destruction just proves the fears that Mordecai had. Again, let's reread the text, and you need to come to your mind on that. Was the reign of Xerxes after Artaxerxes had sent Nehemiah to Jerusalem and after Cyrus had let the exiles return? Yeah, so this is post-exile. So the Jews had returned to Israel. That had been open, but some had remained in that diaspora through the Persian Empire. And so these are people who, like Mordecai and Esther, hadn't gone to Jerusalem. So there's a real issue about how will God deal with the scattered people, and this is part of the answer for that. When should we defy the authorities? Oh, well, that picks up some of the things I've said, I think. Why should we expect a society, a government, a culture that values and respects differing opinions? Shouldn't Christians expect opposition, persecution, having been shut down for their differing opinions? Yeah, look, I think we can say, this is my day job. Freedom for faith is all about kind of thinking, how do we promote religious freedom without being naive and kind of romantic about that? Think, oh yeah, let's all just love each other. Like, we actually, of course there's going to be differences of opinion. The question is, how do we deal with that? Do we think that there'll be no persecution, that we can bring that off? No, we understand that part of the way that the world rebels against God is actually through persecution. So let's not be naive about that. But at the same time, we're called to pray for the king in order that we might live quiet and godly lives. And so you can both have a Caesar who's persecuting the church and honour Caesar and pray that he'll actually back off and you'll have better laws. And that faithful presence into that space and a refusal to just say, oh, well, people are going to be persecuted anyway, is part of the reason the West is in the shape it is. That that Judeo-Christian heritage has actually informed the way that we do government, so that we do have things like rule of law, so that we do have things like tolerance, so that we do actually care about those things as human rights for all, not just for the people that we agree with. Why was the city of Susa bewildered? I think because they've just had this edict go out that a genocide is coming, and there they are in the heart of the empire, wondering what that will mean for them. But come back, and we'll see more of that next week. Thanks, Pope.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.